Thank you for joining me. I'm Julie Vecchio. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or support the podcast on patreon.com/fisheriespodcast, along with Ben, Tyler, Janet, Robin, and John. If you're interested in showing off your support for the show, or a favorite fish species, go check out our merch over at the Fisheries Podcast Fan Shop hosted by Teespring, where you can find t-shirts, hats, stickers, and more. Find the link in the show descriptions. Today, my guest is Jordan Moss. Jordan holds a Bachelor of Science in Veterinary Bioscience and an International Master's of Science degree in Marine Biological Resources. He's currently a trainee at the Center for Marine Science, housed at the University of Algarve in Portugal. In his current role, he seeks to help implement sustainable practices in Dana-limited fisheries. His research group is currently working with an NGO in Sri Lanka called Blue Resources Trust, utilizing length frequency data sets to develop initial assessment models and working to create more big pictures and developing CPUE collection protocols using landing surveys. Welcome to the podcast, Jordan. I'm excited to learn more about your work in Sri Lanka and about your background. I think you might be only the second European that we've had on the show. So welcome to those ranks.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm really excited to do this.
So I noticed that you got your bachelor's degree in veterinary biosciences, and you told me that you worked at the London Aquarium during high school and college. Is that what got you interested in marine science in the first place?
Well, I think I've always been interested. Like, my dad comes from a small fishing village. So even if we grew up in the city, we went back every summer. And yeah, this was really where it started. You know, like, as a kid, you go down to the harbor and you see this diversity of species coming in and all the shapes and sizes and colors. It really, really blows your mind. But I think what the bachelor's and my work at London Zoo did was open my eyes to the extent of the problems faced by the marine planet, the marine resources. For example, working at the zoo, we were working with species that were completely extinct in the wild. And that's really, really crazy to think that these are like 30% of the world's population you're looking at for a certain species.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, that I didn't even think about that. That's pretty amazing. If you're working with species that are only alive at all because they're in captivity, that's really incredible. What were some of those species?
I can't remember the exact species, but it was a type of split fin, which is really, really small little fish found in rivers in Mexico. And basically when these rivers or ponds started to be drained for use in agriculture, the habitat of the species was just gone.
Sure.
And then, yeah, it's a lot of pressure. You know, if you've ever like siphoned a fish tank, if you've got small fish in there, it's really easy to suck one up. And if you suck one of these up, that's a big problem.
yeah, I guess it is. Oh my goodness, I can't even imagine. Oh god. And so growing up, you spent a lot of time, like summers and stuff, at the coast and on the water?
Yeah. So it's like a tiny fishing village right on the northeast coast, and yeah, we spent a lot of time there. I used to do a lot of crabbing, actually. It was like, you know, my parents would just leave me at the harbor with a line, and I'd pull up crab after crab and look at them and then chuck them back. So that's some of my fondest memories as a kid.
Yeah. What kind of crabs? Like teeny tiny ones, or like big ones that you could be eating, or?
I think you can eat them. They definitely eat them in France as a bit of a delicacy, but from a polluted fishing harbor, I wouldn't really recommend.
Oh, sure.
Ones. Yeah.
Yeah. So around here in the southeast of the US, sometimes people will fish for blue crabs off the dock, and they'll use like this little net that kind of, it's just kind of like a little platform net, and then they tie a chicken leg onto it. And it's got a piece, you know, you put it on the end of a rope, and you just like lay it on the bottom of the river or whatever, you just put it off the dock and you put it down to the bottom and the blue crabs come up and start munching on your chicken leg, and then you can just pull them up and chuck them in your cooler or whatever.
No, it's exactly the same here, just that we use bacon instead of chicken.
Bacon. what a use for bacon. My four-year-old would be so devastated that you weren't eating the bacon, you're giving it to the crabs.
My parents would get annoyed sometimes because it would just go missing from the fridge or something.
I can imagine that. At the aquarium, besides these little tiny extinct in the wild fish, did you have other favorite animals to work with there?
That's a hard one. They really had some cool fish there. The blind cavefish were really cool. So it's really weird. They're just like skin grown over the eyes, but we fed them like live food, and they were surprisingly good at working out where the food was. But then apart from this, there are arowana and arapaima, big freshwater fish from the Amazon. And when you feed them, they use suction at the surface, so you chuck the fish in and then you hear this massive clap and they suck all the water in with the fish. They were cool. But I think my favorite was the longhorn cowfish, or also known as the box fish. And it literally looks like a yellow box with horns on it. But we just had one of them and he was a real character. And with cowfish, when they're stressed, they release toxins from their skin. So you had to be really careful to keep him happy. Otherwise, it just poisoned the whole tank.
Yeah, we have those guys around here. I love them. They're so cute, especially when they're little. You can find these little teeny ones sometimes, that are like an inch or something. And they're just like these little tiny boxes with little fins just flapping around like,
I would love to see them in the wild one day. That sounds amazing.
Yeah. In graduate school, you turned toward marine resource management or fisheries management. What got you interested in moving in that direction?
Well, as I say, I'd always had an interest for fish. And then as a young teenager, my dad brought me like a small book on overfishing by Ray Hilburn.
Mm-hmm.
Ray Overfishing, What Everyone Needs to Know, I think. That was a really eye-opening book for me. I think it's the first time I heard about the case of cod in Newfoundland and the orange roughy in New Zealand. And I think that really stuck with me. And then from there, natural progression of interest and doing a bit more research into it. When I had some free options in coursework in my bachelor's, I would write about fisheries resources. And so then that's really where I think it happened.
Yeah. I always feel like once you get hooked, you're just into the fisheries game. Like,
and it's a really cool field, because it's so multidisciplinary. Like, there's a bit of politics, there's a bit of biology, there's a bit of everything, really,
Yeah, definitely. I love that about it. And I really, that you could be doing all kinds of different things all the time. And I think the other thing that I really love is just that you're doing science with immediate effect.
Yeah, that's true. You can do some research and then next year you see that research implemented in policy or whatever is.
Yeah, or at least contributing to whatever policy is being made.
Sometimes not as much as you would like.
No, but I don't know. I mean, at least it's there, it's not just sitting on a shelf somewhere. Your master's program seemed really interesting. When I was looking through your CV, every semester was in a different country in Europe. Is that true?
Yeah. So is really cool, actually. I went from France to Portugal to Ireland, and then my thesis was in Belgium. So it's really great, but it's also quite intense as well, I think on one hand, it's really great for the multidisciplinary aspect we talked about, because you get a diversity of perspectives. For example, in Portugal, I saw some amazing work being done on monitoring small-scale fisheries, you know, but more through a centralized system. Whereas in France, they really have power at the local scale and fisheries cooperatives. So it's just interesting to see different things like that. But I'd say the trade-off is a bit that you don't get those lasting bonds with teachers that I had in my bachelor's, you know, like you don't have the same person teaching you for 2 years where you can really build connections. But I'd still recommend it for people if they're interested in this.
Yeah, sure. That definitely makes sense. I really thought that was neat to be able to see all of the different types of fisheries and different types of management schemes or ways of getting at the management throughout the different countries. That seemed really interesting. Your thesis for your master's degree was in, you said it was in Belgium. Did you say, did I read that it was on sharks?
Yeah, it was on the species of ray we have over here, the thornback ray, Raia clavata. I'm not sure if its range spreads over to the American coast or not, but it was quite cool. We were doing a management strategy evaluation of it. So basically looking at the current way of calculating how much you can catch and comparing it to other methods you could use, like instead of a catch quota, how would the fishery react to restrictions on size or restrictions on effort? And it was quite a novel method developed by some people in Vancouver. So it was the first time it had been applied in Europe, and that was quite exciting.
Yeah, interesting. And so this is a this ray is a targeted fish in Belgium?
Is it a targeted fish? This kind of a comp. I think it's not targeted, but they get a decent price for it when they sell it, you know. So I wouldn't quite bycatch, but it's not the primary target either, you know.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I gotcha. Yeah. It's not really ray just isn't really commonly eaten over here.
The same here in the UK. But if you go to a lot of mainland Europe, then yeah, you see the wings often in the supermarkets.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bit of a problem because it's really, you know, because they just sell the wings, it's really hard to identify which species of ray it is. So there are about 5 or 6 different species that are caught in Belgium. And by the time they make it to the landing site, it's often hard to tell which species you've actually caught, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, definitely. We need some DNA identification there. So can you describe a little bit more about your current job? You're working in Portugal, but working on fisheries issues in Sri Lanka. So that must be pretty challenging.
Yeah. It's a bit challenging, but it's not so bad at the moment, you know, because it's mostly behind a computer anyway. So it doesn't really matter if the computer's in Portugal or Sri Lanka or wherever in the world. But the actual work itself is focusing for the moment on one species as a bit of a case study. And then if it works with this species, we'll move it on to others. And that's the blue-spotted mask ray or Neotrygon indica. Really beautiful species, but just separated out from another species in 2018, so quite new. And the first step here is to develop some growth curves and von Bertalanffy parameters.
Wow. You know, I'm so entrenched in marine fisheries in the Southeast US, where we know most of the basics about most of the species that we care about. It kind of amazes me sometimes when you're at the point of trying to develop the a growth curve for the species. It's amazing.
Yeah. That's one of the things I really noticed between my master's thesis and my traineeship now, is that in the developed or the Western countries, you know, we have a really different idea of what a data-limited species is compared to in a developing country. It's it's crazy how different it is. So yeah, we're developing this growth curve, and I don't know if you're familiar with it, but the problem with sharks and the von Bertalanffy growth parameter is that as soon as sharks or slow-growing species start to get exploited, you really quickly start to lose the larger individuals in the population.
Mm-hmm.
Means that when you try and plot out the growth curve, you've only got like 75% of the lengths represented or something, which means that there's a lot of error at the top end of the L infinity, and that in turn infects the K parameter as well.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a problem in a lot of exploited fish, is that when you're catching the larger individuals, you're really, you know, selecting, putting downward pressure on the size of the entire population. And so, you know, I think that's pretty common. But if you haven't had any eyes on it in, you know, with heavy exploitation for decades, I can imagine it being a much larger problem.
Yeah, exactly. And then that's confounded by the fact that a lot of these data limited assessment models are really, really sensitive to the estimates of L infinity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for example, one of the ones we're using, when I did some testing, if you change the L infinity parameter by just 10 centimeters, you can go from a completely sustainable stock to a completely exploited stock. So there's not much margin for error, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Especially, you know, you don't have very much data to put into your model. It's hard to get an accurate answer out. And
one of the ways we're trying to solve that is, we may not have an idea about the older individuals, but they're from the catch data, there's a lot of pregnant females, which is obviously not a good thing, but it does mean that we have quite a good idea of the exact size they are when they're born. And then if we use the L0 instead of the T0 parameter, we can really ground the model in the right place. So I'm not sure how much it helps, but this is the best thing we got so far.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it definitely makes sense.
So this is also like the one good thing about sharks is that, the ones that the live birth at least. And then the next step is to develop these data-limited models, and they will give us some length-based indicators on how the population's doing, and then make some Leslie matrices, hopefully, that's what I'm working on at the moment, to see what the ideal levels should be for the indicators. And then if we could get those three things together, that would be really nice.
You haven't visited Sri Lanka yet, right?
No, I haven't, but actually just today, it's funny, a couple of hours before we started calling, I found out that we got accepted for the Save Our Seas grant, which was the big grant we applied for this project. So now I can tell you confidently that, I will be going to Sri Lanka.
And you said some of the long-term goals for this project are really to set up CPUE data collection protocols and landing mm-hmm. surveys.
You know, the Blue Resource Trust, they're doing amazing work, but it's just not feasible to go out and do fishery surveys to get CPUE data, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we've gone back to some old FAO documents from the late 90s and early 2000s, where they really lay out a process that you can collect catch and effort data from landing sites. And we're kind of adapting this to Sri Lanka. Hopefully that's the overall goal of the project. But it's really hard, you know, because the boats there's a lot of small boats and they're just landing up on the beaches, you know.
Mm.
So there's a bottleneck for where you can just go and collect them. So that's going to be one of the main challenges, I think.
Yeah, that seems like it would be really hard. I mean, just everybody just, you know, pulling their little boat up on the beach. And
yeah, I mean, literally, if you're interested, you can go and look at the satellite images from Google Maps. And if you look along a lot of the beaches in Sri Lanka, you'll see a bunch of canoes mm-hmm. hanging up on the beaches.
Sometimes we have similar issues in Florida recreational fisheries, right? The commercial fishermen have to go to certain places to land, and you know, there's only a certain number and they're all registered and everything else. But recreational fisheries here is a totally different beast. Everybody loves going fishing, and you know, lots of people just put their boats in the water at their house or, you know, whatever. And you never see anything again out of them. So it's actually, it's actually a parallel issue.
Yeah. Do you, are there any like citizen science projects over there to try and quantify that? Because I've seen a few over here where they, you know, try and get the fishermen to download an app or something and record what they catch.
Yeah, there are a few apps. Those are starting to take off relatively slowly. I mean, we still use a ton of intercepts at boat ramps and stuff like that. And so, you know, we know we're not catching the people who, again, who are leaving from their own house, but, you know, anybody that uses a boat ramp or goes to a public fishing dock or something like that, they definitely try to intercept all of the, or not all, but, you know, the intercepts are on that population of fishers. Okay. They have people going out and asking them about their catch and measuring it and all that kind of stuff. It's a pretty labor-intensive process. There's a lot of people that do that throughout the region. But it definitely is still, you know, a major challenge. You still have to do a lot of statistics to figure out, you know, to get any kind of handle on total numbers at all.
Yeah, for sure. It's a big challenge. It's something that's ignored a bit too much in the UK. I feel like the impacts that recreational fishers have on marine populations, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, recreational fishing has just been growing over the decades. You know, Florida has obviously had huge recreational fishing pressure for, I don't know, for decades for sure. And, you know, we know it. But a lot of other areas are definitely, I think, have really increased in the last few decades in terms of like the number of headboats that are going, the number of private boats that go out fishing.
Do they see bow fishing over there? That's the fishing with a bow and arrow?
I don't know. I've heard about a little, but I don't really know that it's common here. I think it's really a shallow water thing. And most of our marine fisheries are definitely deeper. There's definitely spear fishing. Okay, and people spearfish on scuba for a lot of species. I know it's kind of, it's funny too. I've lived in different parts of the country. And even though it's legal in California, it is just not done. You do not wear a tank to shoot a fish.
I think it's illegal over here as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, it's illegal in a lot of places. Bahamas, it's definitely illegal, you know, throughout the Caribbean, I think. But it is legal in the U.S., but there's just a culture around it in different places. In Florida, people do it all the time. And when I lived in California, it was definitely completely frowned upon. It was just like, you're cheating. You don't get to do that.
Yeah. I guess if you're going out to catch what you eat, you know, it's one thing, like, why not wear a scuba? But if you're going out for a competition or something, or then it's a bit different.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was definitely cultural. Although I think that some of the major targets in California were very spooky. They were easily spooked, and so you really couldn't have bubbles around them, or they would just take off. So it might have grown out of a practicality to it.
Okay, that's really interesting how things like that can influence.
Yeah, I don't know for sure, but yeah. Definitely some of the you know, the big targets, the ones that people really wanted to shoot, would, you'd never see them if you had bubbles. So are you living in the same, you did a semester in Portugal, right?
Yeah, that's where I met my current supervisor. He was my teacher back then.
Okay.
And I really liked the stuff he was teaching, and he seemed like a cool person. So after I finished, there was this grant money to do the traineeship. And I sent him over a message like, would you be interested in applying together? And he was happy.
Yeah. So you made that connection in Portugal, and then you were able to come back for a job. Is the traineeship, is that a term job, like there's a specific amount of time that it is that the job is for?
Yeah, so it's funded by the EU. They mm-hmm. give out a certain amount of money, so that it's kind of a scheme to get people into work after they graduate. So for 1 year after you graduate, if you propose a topic and they like it, they'll give you 1 year's salary. But the problem is they give you the salary all at once, you know, or they give you 70% at once.
Wow.
So then you're really good at budgeting.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's a 1 year job, and how long have you been doing it now?
How long have it? Since I started in September.
Okay.
But obviously it's been a bit hard with COVID and stuff, because I've been in and out of the office trying to work from home.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer being in the office, but you just, when you're working from home, I guess you just have to be strict with yourself, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely true. And I think especially if you don't have a lot of, you know, inherent rhythm to your day or interruptions or whatever, like I said, I have a 4-year-old and he goes to preschool, you know, 5 or 6 hours a day. And so I know that those are the hours that I am going to be alone in my house and I can work for sure. You know, otherwise I got to catch the rest of the hours kind of as, you know, in and out between meals and everything else.
Yeah, so that's quite nice to, like, it forces you to have a bit of structure in your day.
Yeah, I don't think I would do so well if I didn't have any kind of, you know, structure.
Yeah, because for me, I don't know, I find when you're working at home, you know, it kind of, it stops your home becoming a place to relax. Like, you always feel that you should be working, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I felt that way. I think a lot of people really feel that way, you know, during their graduate degrees too.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely, you really got to be your own disciplinarian, right? This is work time. This is not work time.
Yeah.
What's your favorite part about living in Portugal?
So they have this Rio Formosa. I think it's like saltwater marshes, basically. Mm. And it's just amazing. You know, at the end, there's this big sandbar that's become a beach, you know, and they put some houses there. And so you can cycle through the salt marshes on your way to the beach. And there's just a huge diversity of birds and seahorses in the Rio, in the marshes, and good fishing for bream on the beach. So yeah, spent a lot of evenings watching the sunset from the beach and drinking a beer. That's the best part of Portugal, I think.
That sounds pretty amazing. Yeah, I would love to visit there. That'd be so cool.
Yeah, it's really, I think it's, out of all the places I went in Europe, that was the most like naturally beautiful.
Mm-hmm. So thinking back on your time so far in marine science, what do you think is one of your favorite memories?
I think, obviously, because I wasn't really in studying marine science before I started my master's, the first few days of my master's were really amazing. Like, you know, finally being in a room with other people as interested in fish as I was. And at the start, I was in France at this beautiful research station overlooking the bay. And yeah, I think the real excitement that, you know, it was my dream to study and research fish, and that was the day my dream became a reality, you know?
So you have a 1 year traineeship right now. If you were dreaming big and money were no object, what would be a project that you would love to pursue after this?
Deep sea sharks, without a question, you know, like chimera and mini chimera, but I think they're just fascinating. They look like something out of a sci-fi movie. I don't know if you've ever seen them.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Chimeras, they're crazy.
Yeah. I think they really captured my imagination. You know, when I first saw them, I was like, oh my God, what is that thing? I'd love to know what they eat, how long they live, how connected they are, I think could be really interesting. You know, like they're found all over the world, but because I'm wondering if they're, are they traveling long distances, you know, on the bottom, or are they really localized? Stuff like that would be amazing.
Yeah, that would be so cool.
But unfortunately, there's not a lot of money out there to study chimera, at least in fish, you know?
No, that's definitely true. They're not a heavily targeted fishery species. So we're all pretty passionate about, you know, fisheries and science and everything like that, but we are also people in the world, and I always like to remind myself that. So what are some things that you like to do outside of your job?
Yeah, I think it's important to remind yourself of that sometimes. I like climbing and bouldering a lot. That's a nice one for me, you know, because it's physical exercise, but you also have to use your brain and some critical thinking, you know, to think about where your hand should go or what the next move is. Fishing I love, especially river fishing, you know, going out by myself and just with a spinning rod and walking up and down the river, casting away. That's where I do my big thinking, I think.
Yeah, you always got to have something like that where you can really do your big thinking.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. So as a kid, I played a lot of strategy games, like computer ones like Total War, or board games like Risk. And in lockdown, now that I don't really have anything to do to relax, I've been going back to those a lot. So that's been nice, actually. I didn't touch them since I was like 15, 16, you know, and now.
I think a lot of times, you know, going back to those things that you really loved as a kid or a teenager sometimes is just really, really nice.
Yeah, it's a bit of a nostalgia fest, but with that sometimes.
But it's just really relaxing, and it keeps you going.
Yeah, exactly. What have you been doing to keep yourself going? And are you in lockdown over there? Or what's the deal?
Florida doesn't lock down.
Okay.
I mean, I haven't personally done anything. You know, I haven't been to a restaurant in a year or, you know, any place where other people might be.
Yeah.
But, you know, there isn't an official lockdown. There's no...
Must be hard with a four-year-old. Eh?
Yeah. Well, you know, he does go to preschool. So there is that. We don't... He's been going out a few hours, you know, at least 4 or 5 hours a day. Keeping ourselves entertained with a four-year-old is not always the hardest thing in the world. You can just running, jumping, you know, I did get a trampoline for us for Christmas for all of us. So we do spend a lot of time on the trampoline, running, jumping, climbing, biking, cooking, you know, just Legoing. He is
a Lego.
Massive Lego nut. He just loves to build Legos constantly.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So you're stepping on a lot of them when you find them around.
Yeah, we try to keep them contained, but you know, they escape. Now the tough part of the interview is over, and it's on to my final questions. So we always like to start with what we consider the easy question. What is your favorite fish?
Oh my God, this is not an easy question for me. I'd say maybe the thresher shark. I have a tattoo of a thresher shark on my back, and I don't know, I just love the fact they slap fish with their tail before they eat them. And
isn't that cool?
Yeah, like, you know, just some of the things nature comes up with, it's just crazy.
I don't have any hands. I guess I'll slap it with my tail.
Yeah, exactly. And I think they just look beautiful as well, you know, with the long tail trailing behind them. And if you've ever, like, you know, we have this perception of sharks in the media and in like Hollywood as these scary animals. But if you look at the face of a thresher shark, you know, it's got these big eyes and these characteristics of a juvenile, you know, and it's really cute, actually. Mola molas is another one.
Yeah.
They would be cool.
They are so cool.
And I feel so bad for them. Have you seen the stuff with them and sea lions where...
Yeah, the sea lions and throw them around and stuff.
Yeah.
They're fast, though. If they want to get away from you, most of the time they can do it.
Oh, really?
They can. I mean, if they get scared, they can take off. I don't know what's the deal with the sea lion thing, but for the most part, you know, if they can flap those fins and get out of there. So what do you think is your dream job or location?
For a few years, I'd love to go to like some really tiny remote island, you know, and just manage like the only fishery on the island, you know, just somewhere quiet like that, somewhere you can really develop your ideas from the ground up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because here or in like well-developed countries, you know, there's a lot of infrastructure already in place, so you can't really just think up an idea and then test it, you know.
And my final question, if there was one point or principle you would have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
I thought about this a lot, actually. And I was thinking maybe the precautionary principle. So I don't know, for me, like a big influence was Rachel Carson and all the work she did with pesticides and chemicals. And so, yeah, I think if everyone just when it came to the natural world had a precautionary approach, you know, so if they said like, okay, we're not 100% sure what's going to happen here, so let's just play it safe. I think the world would be a better place if that happened.
Well, Jordan, thank you so much for being a guest on the show. If people want to connect with you online or learn more about your work, where can they find you?
So they can reach me on social media, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn. Otherwise, I'm sure you can put my email in the name of the podcast or something, and they can reach me there.
That's sure can.
Yeah. And I'd be happy to answer any questions from anyone.
Thank you to everyone for listening to this 109th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. If you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FishVecchio. The podcast is at Fisheries Pod on Facebook and Instagram at Fisheries Podcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. Thank you for listening, and remember, use the precautionary principle when dealing with nature.
Could we just pause for 1 second?
Yeah.
I'm not sure how much detail to go into with like the statistics and the different stuff like that, you know?
I mean, I guess that's a good question. I mean, in terms of like bumvert is pretty common in the field. Yeah. Legos have taken over our whole house. It's pretty amazing.
Nice, nice. Okay.